Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies today. My name is Andrew Schwartz, and I'm CSIS's Vice President for External Relations. And I have the pleasure of introducing this gentleman, Dr. Rob Sabbany, who is known to many of you for various things that he's done. He's done so many things. But we're here today to talk about Rob's new book, and we'll get to that in a minute. Rob is president, as you know, Rob is president and founder of Caspian Energy Consulting. He founded the company in 1991 to specialize in negotiating projects for clients with business interests in the Middle East and the former Soviet Union. Until 2005, he was an adjunct professor at Georgetown, where he taught courses on U.S. foreign policy and energy security. There are scores of people who have taken Rob's classes throughout Washington, and I often meet many of them. Dr. Sabbany is also a frequent contributor to op-ed pages of U.S. newspapers. He's frequently quoted. He's also appeared dozens and dozens and scores of times on domestic and international television and radio broadcasts. Besides his professional and academic background, Dr. Sabbany sits on the board or of is affiliated with a number of organizations, including Mohawk Innovative Technologies and Washington Capital Partners. Rob is also a member of the Bipartisan Committee on the Present Danger. But as I said, Rob is here today to talk about this wonderful book, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, A Leader of Consequence. The book is so excellent, and not just because you can do curls with it. It's a heavyweight book for what's in it and for physically how much it weighs. And on the way out, we always have somebody at CSIS selling books, and you can pick them up. But today, through Rob's graciousness, he'll be giving away these books back. So please get your copy before you leave. These are wonderful books, and I think you'll find inside them is a treasure trove of rare photos, insight, and thoughtful research and journalism on just this leader of consequence. With that, I'll let Rob tell you more about his great book, and following Rob's remarks, we'll take a few questions and answers. Thank you so much. Rob?
Well, it's good to be here today. I want to thank CSIS for putting this event together. I'd like to have a special thanks to my good friend, Dr. Fireborz Gadar, who brought this event to CSIS and suggested that we do it here, and I thank Fireborz for taking the initiative. I want to also thank Andrew for your kindness and your remarks, and Allison, wherever you are, thank you very much for putting it together. So I thank CSIS, and there are a few people I also want to thank. If you like the design and if you like the cover, you can thank the folks at Xanthus Design. I cannot proceed without mentioning their kind efforts in designing this, and also the myriad of numbers of people that I met in Saudi Arabia whom I talked to, and I thank them, because this book also is about them. So I wanted to thank them as well. Why did I write this book, I suppose? You know, everyone asks, you know, why did I write this book? Let me give you an anecdote of why I wrote this book. It was the 2007 OPEC summit, and I was privileged to be in the hall where all the heads of state were meeting. And true to form, Hugo Chavez and President Ahmadinejad got up, and for half hour each of them were ranting and raving, and there came a very critical point where they were shifting the entire debate from using OPEC and the dollar, I'm sorry, as a basket of currency, the dollar in OPEC, and moving it to the euro. And at that moment, King Abdullah, very quietly but very firmly, basically shut them up and brought the discussion back to where it belonged. And it was at that moment I was listening to that and looking at that that I realized, you know what, this guy is different. This gentleman is different. He has done something consequential. And so I took it upon myself to write a book. And as I got on the plane, I decided to do a little more research, and I found one of his speeches that he gave in Mecca on the occasion of the Organization of Islamic Countries. And in that speech, if you read it, and it's in my book, he talks about a Muslim renaissance. He talks about a new beginning for the Muslim world. And once again, it reiterated for me, reconfirmed for me, that King Abdullah is different. And he certainly was changing the tone and tenor of the debate within the Muslim world. And so I decided to write this because as I started writing it 2.5 years ago and as I got into it, I really came to the conclusion that what King Abdullah does matters. What King Abdullah does matters. And that's really the theme of this book. Whether it's in energy security, whether it's fighting Islamic extremists, global economic recovery, the future of Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, what King Abdullah does matters to the world. Yes, the President of the United States, the President of Russia, the President of China. But King Abdullah also matters, and matters enormously. And that's why I decided to write this book. Now, let me just put this in historical context. Saudi Arabia has always been an important ally of the United States. From that moment when President Roosevelt and King Abdulaziz sat on that boat together and forged an alliance, Saudi Arabia has always been part and parcel of foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy. But I would venture to say no Saudi leader has ever transformed Saudi Arabia to the extent that King Abdullah has. He has done what no other Saudi leader has done before. And that's what makes him unique. Yes, Saudi Arabia is the world's central bank of petroleum, has the largest reserves. Saudi Arabia is home to the two most holiest sites of Islam. Saudi Arabia is the heavyweight of the Arab world. But what makes it unique and makes it different is who runs Saudi Arabia, and it's King Abdullah. And let me just run through six things that I think makes King Abdullah so different. And I'm going to go into it very briefly because I'd like to get an interaction and questions and answer. The first, I believe, very important, is the dialogue that King Abdullah has started, both within Saudi Arabia and outside. And I'll get to this in a moment. His dialogue projects. The second, in my opinion, the empowerment of reform-minded individuals and technocrats with vision today are running Saudi Arabia. Third, King Abdullah has taken it upon himself to challenge the extremists and their rhetoric. And this is unique as well. He has the courage, and I like to emphasize this, he has the courage to stand up to the extremists and use their rhetoric against them. Fourth, Saudi Arabia is, in my opinion, the leader in the Middle East of the arc of stability versus the arc of instability fostered by Iran, the regime in Tehran, Ayatollah Khamenei, Ahmadinejad. And the example of that, as I mentioned earlier to you, was visual, clear at the OPEC summit. Fifth, Saudi Arabia's reforms under King Abdullah have made the system more transparent. Saudi Arabia's stock exchange is today the 10th largest in the world. And I would say as an American citizen, if I had money, I wouldn't put it in Citibank. I put it in Saudi Arabia. Very simple, because I don't trust Citibank, but I would trust the King of Saudi Arabia more than I would trust Citibank because of the reforms that the King Abdullah has instituted in Saudi Arabia. And finally, sixth, and most important, or equally important, I should say, the King has emphasized education and building of universities and schools as houses of wisdom. He uses that word, and that's very, very interesting and liberating. He talks about universities as houses of wisdom, not just to go in, learn something, and come out. These are, from the perspective of King Abdullah, houses of wisdom, and that's very, very important and very key. So let me just very briefly go through the six items that I mentioned. I was traveling to Taif. I don't know how many, I mean, I'm sure some of you have been to Taif. For the young people in the audience, I never thought I'd see monkeys, but I saw monkeys in Taif. But other than that, talking to people that came out of the mosque on a Friday, I went and talked to people about King Abdullah in Taif. I spoke to people in Dammam in the eastern province. These were Shia. I talked to businessmen. And without exception, they all said that the King's National Dialogue Forum has been a godsend. And so I would venture to say, if I were to come away from this book and King Abdullah, the institutionalization of a free dialogue space within Saudi Arabia will be one of the legacies of King Abdullah, without doubt. The second thing that I think is worth noting is, once again, the importance of the technocrats that he's put in place. People like Prince Faisal at the Education Ministry. People like the ambassador here, not from the royal family, mind you, but a young person through meritocracy rising to become the ambassador of Saudi Arabia in the United States. Or Noura Al-Fayez, the deputy education minister, for the first time. It's very interesting. The night that this appointment was announced, I was in Riyadh, and I was in the elevator, and a few ladies were on the elevator, and they were giddy and all happy, and I said, congratulations. And they said, no, it's not, don't congratulate us, congratulate King Abdullah, because without him, this would not have been possible. So I venture to say that the women of Saudi Arabia are certainly very blessed to have King Abdullah as their leader. The third area, foreign policy. I would venture to say that King Abdullah is indeed the peacemaker. When he sees an image of fighting between Hamas and Fatah, tears come to his eyes. He invites them without telling his foreign minister and invites Hamas and Fatah to come to Mecca and to sit down and work out their differences. This is a man who firmly believes in peace. This is a man who offered Israel, and it's still valid, his offer, to make peace with Israel in exchange for recognition. He is a peacemaker at heart. And this is, I suppose, juxtaposed to the inflammatory rhetoric that one sees coming from Iran. While Iran is the arc of instability, as I mentioned earlier, King Abdullah and Saudi Arabia are certainly the arc of stability in the region. The other factor that I'd like to talk about is, as I said, his courageous attempt to fight the extremists, what he calls deviants, with their rhetoric. I remember a story recounted by someone in Saudi Arabia who was privy to a meeting between a group of ulema who went to see the king. Their complaint? That satellites were immoral. That satellites were corrupting the mind. And it infuriated the king so much that he kicked him out of his office. He did not like that kind of language. And instead, And let me go back to an important point. He can stand up to these extremists because he's a pious person. And anywhere in Saudi Arabia that I go, the people that I've visited, the one thing they mention about King Abdullah is that he's a pious person. And when you're pious and religious, you can stand up to people who are ignorant. And I think that's served King Abdullah very, very well. The fifth factor is, once again, the enormous transparency that has been brought to the table since King Abdullah on economic reform. I was in Jeddah one night speaking with 15 businessmen some time ago. They were talking about reverse mergers. They were talking about taking private companies public, public companies private. And I said, whoa, and investing, incidentally, millions and millions of dollars. And I asked them, I said, what gives? What's happened? And without exception, they said, we're confident because behind us stands King Abdullah. He has brought a level of transparency and reform to the Saudi financial sector, financial markets, that gives confidence to the private sector. And that's what's really driving the private sector in Saudi Arabia. or, for example, a talk with a banker in Saudi Arabia, in Jeddah, who was saying that since the advent of King Abdullah, things have gotten a lot better from a banking perspective. So I would say, as I venture to say, if I were American, I would certainly have no hesitation to take my money and put it in a three-year CD in Saudi Arabia. Plus, you get a better rate of return. Finally, this is once again, in my opinion, another lasting legacy of King Abdullah, is education. He is changing Saudi Arabia by institutionalizing education reform. Whether it is the King Abdullah University for Science and Technology, which many now believe is going to be the MIT of the Middle East, or whether it's a school around the corner in Taif. But what the king is doing is, as I mentioned earlier, is creating homes and houses of wisdom. And that's how he approaches education. And I think this is very, very important for the future of Saudi Arabia, for the future of the region, because what happens in Saudi Arabia matters to the world. I'd like to emphasize one other point about King Abdullah, and I'll go to question and answers. When I spoke to a family outside of McDonald's, this was in Al Khobar, the family said that they have been the beneficiary of King Abdullah's philanthropy. Apparently, the king gets up from his office and, without telling anyone, decides to head out to places where he thinks people are in need. And he'll surprise the people in that area. And if they're not taken care of, he'll get angry and he'll get upset. But the people who are less fortunate become the beneficiary of his philanthropy. A few years ago, if you recall, we had a world food crisis. King Abdullah gave $500 million to the World Food Organization. $500 million. His philanthropy has extended to solving world hunger, to Lebanon, to Haiti. Recently, the king gave $50 million to the victims in Haiti. And Palestinian territories. But his philanthropy has also come to our neighborhood as well. And I'd like to acknowledge someone in the crowd. I don't know, Veronica. Can you stand up for a second? Veronica Nolan is from the Urban Alliance. Her organization has been the beneficiary of King Abdullah. Veronica is the mother to, and I say this euphemistically, but she is the head of Urban Alliance, which takes care of underprivileged children in Baltimore and Washington. King Abdullah reached out to Veronica. And today, thanks to the king, there are children in the Baltimore-Washington area who are the beneficiaries of his philanthropy. So whether it's, thank you very much. So whether it's Haiti, Lebanon, or right here in Baltimore-Washington area, this is a man who feels for the people, feels their pain. And yes, there are many, many issues that remain to be solved in Saudi Arabia. No one doubts that what the king is doing is a Herculean task. There are still issues that remain to be solved. But there is no doubt in my mind that if the president of the United States reaches out to King Abdullah and says, I want to be your partner, the king will shake his hand in all honesty, and they can sit down and solve, I'm not saying all the problems, but there are certain problems that with partnership with King Abdullah can be resolved. And that's why the title of the book, King Abdullah, A Leader of Consequence. I'll leave it for your questions and answers. And I thank you very much for coming today. Appreciate it.
We'll be passing microphones around in back. And if you could state your name and your organization you're with, that would be very helpful. Right down here in front.
Hi. Hi. I'm Christy Bonna from USERF, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. You mentioned that King Abdullah is an initiator of dialogue, and certainly he created the Interfaith Dialogue Initiative, and which hosted a conference in Madrid in 2008, and Saudi Arabia served on the UN Human Rights Council in 2009. I'm wondering if you could shed some light onto some of the discrepancies between his coordinated efforts to promote these ideals in international fora versus the very slow to manifest realities. We haven't really seen these changes on the ground domestically. What do you think can account for this discrepancy?
The team is trying to reform Saudi Arabia on multiple levels, as I said, foreign policy, domestic policy, economic policy, but certainly these can be used in women's policy. The fact that today, through the national dialogue, Shia's voice there can be something that probably a few years ago would be a taboo subject. So the team from conversations that I've had with these people is aware that there is much more to be done on this issue. The team is aware that there are certain religious freedoms that need to be addressed, and he's aware of it. Now, having said that, he's up against very formidable opponents. Opponents who are entrenched, opponents who use violence, and the king wants to institute these reforms without violence. His goal is to get to the point of religious tolerance without the violence. But his opponents, unfortunately, and I've seen those opponents, I've talked to those opponents, I've sat and I've seen those opponents, they are very close-minded, they're very narrow-minded, they will not accept. As someone worthy of consideration, let alone a Christian, let alone a Jew, let alone a Baha'i, let alone whatever. So he's up against formidable opponents, but he's moving forward. Is it at the pace we want? No, unfortunately not, but he's certainly going in that direction. Does that answer your question? If not, please, I mean, I'm...
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Well, I believe that he is giving his best shot, and I think it will happen. It may not be as fast as we want, but I'm sure you visited. But when I visited Saudi Arabia, and not just Saudi Arabia, when you visit Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, and you talk to these extremists, they're very adamant in opposing, but opposing with violence. And that's the unfortunate thing. It's very difficult to operate in an environment when your opponent, all he wants to do is kill you if you talk about religious freedom or you talk about women's rights. So it's very difficult. But he's on the right track, in my opinion.
We'll go to a question in the back.
Hi there. Afshin Malavi from the New America Foundation. Rob, congratulations on publishing this book. And I remember I was with you at that OPEC summit in 2007 in Riyadh, and what was very striking is the kind of the personal relations that King Abdullah had with the heads of state that he was dealing with. And one of the things I'd like to ask you about, I mean, you laid out, I thought, the policy very well, but when you spoke with intimates of the king, when you spoke with maybe family members of the king or those who've dealt with him personally, what was the sense you got of what he's like as a person? What he's like as an individual. So I think that would be really interesting, particularly given, as you know, within the region, personality plays such an outsized role in politics.
Let me answer that question by a question. And for those of you who read the book, I guess it's easy to answer. But how many of you know what's King Abdullah's favorite music? Anybody? Venture a guess? What's his favorite music? No. Well, I asked this question from his daughter, and his daughter said his favorite music is the sound of rain. Well, it made sense. This is a man who grew up, in the desert, and the sound of rain is music to his ears. So his daughter went on to say that my father is an environmentalist at heart. And our discussion went into climate change and went into a discussion of how her father sees Earth, actually, as something God-given, and that he feels very strongly about the issue of global warming and climate change, and has instructed Ali Naimi, the energy minister, to look for technologies that would be cutting edge to address the issue of carbon sequestration, to address the issue of renewables. And so at least on one level, there's no doubt that he, from a personal standpoint, is an environmentalist. Now, I was speaking to his grandsons, and one of the grandsons was telling me a story about how one of the other cousins he didn't mention was, stopped for a traffic violation, and he tried to pull off the "I'm a prince" excuse, and when it came back to his grandfather, it infuriated his grandfather, because this little boy told me that his grandfather has told him that you're like any other normal Saudi. Just because you have the title prince doesn't make you any different than anybody else. And when you meet King Abdullah's family, you will really see this, because that's exactly how they act. When you talk to his daughter, when you talk to his granddaughter, who's in some the ones that I talk to in their 20s, when you talk to his grandchildren, you will find the same mindset. They do not think themselves as above or better. They are representatives, as they said to me, ambassadors of the king. And that's how they approach it. So the king believes, to answer your question, in inequality. You know, just because you're a prince doesn't make you any different. And he's put that rule down for his family members as well.
I'd like to ask a question, actually, Rob. And I'm shocked that neither of the first two questions were, where do you get a CD in Saudi Arabia, or how do you get a CD in Saudi Arabia? But of all the leaders in throughout the rest of the world, who does King Abdullah consider the most important leader of consequence?
You mean, who does King Abdullah consider? I would venture to say, from one of the few sessions that I had with the king, but also his advisors and the people who advise the king, that he considers certainly the United States still to be the most important power in the world, economically, culturally, because of our diplomatic heft. King Abdullah still considers the United States a significant power. And U.S.-Saudi relations will always be a very significant element in King Abdullah's foreign policy. But the second was China. He considers China and the Chinese leaders to be of consequence. You talk to his energy minister, Mr. Naimi, or you talk to his foreign policy team. It's very clear that while America has a special place, there is no doubt that the emergence of China has a major influence on King Abdullah's thinking. And he sees China as a country of consequence, whether it's the president of China as a consequential, I'm not sure, but certainly China is consequential. There's no doubt about it. Now, of negative consequence, I should say, are people who the king feels are not acting in the true Muslim tradition. And without naming names, I can also mention the regime in Iran. You know, he feels they are not acting in the true Muslim way, which is to honor the faith, to use the faith to build, to serve the people. And so there are leaders of consequence, and then there are leaders of consequence in the negative sense as well. So it works both ways for the king.
Question right over here.
My name is Kani Zulam. I'm with the American Kurdish Information Network. Okay. What do you make of a family owning a whole country? Do you really believe he could be a role model for the massive problems that face the peoples of the Middle East? Beware of the Greeks bearing gifts is a proverb. I wonder if you could comment on his gifts in terms of madrasas that are being built in Southeast Asia.
Well, you know, the what has happened since the ascension of King Abdullah, at least from my perspective, and based on my interviews and my talking to people in Saudi Arabia, normal Saudis, tells me that things are different. Things are moving in the direction of transparency. Is it 100%? No. Could there be more? Yes. But certainly, under the leadership of King Abdullah, things are moving. The pendulum is moving in the right direction. Let me pause for a second to answer your first question, the first issue that you noted, you know, owning a country. As an American citizen, I can tell you that if you did some background checks on our members of Congress, you will find written on their back, you know, NAACP maybe, or AARP, or some other lobbyist or industry. You know, I think before we criticize other countries, at least me personally, I would look at the mirror and I would look at my own country and say, you know, what's wrong with my country before criticizing another country. I wrote this book because I firmly believe that the King of Saudi Arabia matters, what he's doing is important, and what he does affects all of us. If King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia on the 2007 OPEC summit had shook hands with Hugo Chavez and Ahmadinejad and said, you know what, guys, hallelujah, let's jack up the price to $150, we wouldn't even be at this event because we'd have to drive cars and put gas of $6, $7 a gallon in our car. So it does matter. It does matter that the King of Saudi Arabia thinks about not just his country, but thinks about the consumers of this energy as well. That's just one example. But I'm not disagreeing with you on the overall premise of your question. More can be done. And I think the king himself would admit to that. Saudis would admit to that, but it's come a long way. That's just my perspective and my you know, the way I see it.
Question over here.
I had a question about it. You mentioned Ahmadinejad and Iran several times. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about King Abdullah's thoughts on Iran policy-wise, how the international community should deal with Iran, and specifically how Saudi Arabia should deal with Iran.
Excuse me. Time and again, when I've spoken to the king's close inner circle and his foreign policy team, intellectuals, but let's just go back to the king, okay, and his immediate circle. Time and again, they mention that Iran is a country with a rich history. Iran is a country with a deep culture, language, and deserving of a better government. Okay? They see hope within Iran, within the Iranian people. And I think the major disconnect with Washington is that while Washington, at least now, may feel there's a need for engagement, in Saudi Arabia and the circles around the king, they look more to the Iranian people. They see a nation that has the potential to contribute and contribute positively to the region. And that's what they hope to see. But can they influence U.S. policy? Maybe not. They're looking to us to make that policy. But in terms of, let me go back again to the issue of Iran and the nuclear. Certainly, there is consternation in the region. I'm saying this because I've met with most of the leaders in that region. Iran is the number one threat from their perspective. A nuclear Iran is very dangerous for them. Whether you talk to the Bahrainis, Kuwaitis, Qataris, Saudis, UAE, they're very concerned. But I, once again, they also repeat what King Abdullah's advisors are saying, which is the people of Iran have a rich culture and history, proven themselves. And if this heavy iron fist could be lifted, they could contribute. And they're looking for the day when the Iranian people and government can contribute positively. I don't know if that answers your question. Follow up, please.
I wanted to just take it a step further.
Sure.
Meaning what in terms of policies? Do they favor containment? Are they against dialogue?
I think that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, they all favor dialogue. No one is against dialogue. Absolutely. They want dialogue because they don't want war. I can tell you that there is absolutely no appetite for a war with Iran. Absolutely no appetite. But I think that they're putting their emphasis from a policy perspective on where is Washington on the human rights issue? Where is Washington on helping the Iranian nation? Because this is a nation with 2,500 years of history. It has the potential to contribute positively to the region. I won't name the country because, it was off the record, but I've talked to many ministers and heads of state who recall the days before this regime. And they would say, we could work with this. We could work with that, with that previous government, because there was stability. And that was without foreign interference, i.e. the U.S. I don't know if that's... Does that answer your question? There was another question in the back.
Mark Finley with BP.
Mm-hmm.
A leader of consequence leaves a lasting legacy. So what are your perspectives on, the degree to which these reforms continue after Abdullah?
Well, that's a very good question. BP is beyond petroleum, and I think the legacy beyond King Abdullah will be, in my opinion, the institutionalization of this free zone of exchange of ideas, really. And hopefully it'll continue beyond the king, because for the first time, a king has had the courage to open up the political environment, the political cultural environment, to discuss subjects that were never discussed before. Corruption is now talked about openly. When there were floods in Jeddah and people died, the king fired princes, fired people who were responsible for it. He doesn't discriminate. You do a bad job, you get fired. And so I think his lasting legacy would be to open up Saudi Arabia and the discourse to subjects that were taboo. And I think that's his lasting legacy. Beyond that, I think the other lasting legacy, which would relate to probably your industry, would be opening up of a transparent economic zone, really. I mean, if you're BP, you go into Saudi Arabia, you can work in full transparency. And if you're a businessman, you go into Saudi Arabia, you can work in full transparency. Saudi Arabia is now the only Arab country that's a member of the G20. Saudi Arabia is the... 10th in terms of doing business ranking by the IFC. So those are the two probably, in my opinion, lasting legacies of King Abdullah.
Quite right over here.
Thank you. Rushdie Yunsi with ExxonMobil. I was wondering if you could comment on the way King Abdullah is managing succession politics.
That's another institution that King Abdullah has put in place, the Succession Council, Secretary General of which is a very, very learned person, Khaled Twejri, whose father was a mentor to King Abdullah. I'd like to just diverge very quickly, very, very briefly. The elder Twejri was the mentor of King Abdullah, and the theme that was always discussed between the two men was Arab Enlightenment, that there was a period in Arab history, you go back to Baghdad, Damascus, as centers of learning, that's the Arab nationalism that King Abdullah believes in. A jihad to build planes, not a jihad to slam planes into buildings. That's the mindset of the king. Now going back to your question, he instituted the Succession Council, and basically, instead of an automatic next person becomes the ruler, it's going to be decided among a group of people. in a fairly transparent way, and whoever the group votes for gets to be the next king. It's novel, it's unique, but I think from what I understand from talking to Mr. Touadri and others, is the king wanted to once again institutionalize the succession so that when he one day goes, is not around, it doesn't become an ad hoc, quick succession. It is well thought out, debated among the family, and to institutionalize this. So I think, from your competitor or partner, BP, question about institutionalization of the dialogue, institutionalization of education, I think the succession is the institutionalization of the succession is also a legacy of the king.
I hope that answers your question. As to who will be the next king? Assassinated. And Kissinger thought about it and said, I don't know what would have happened to the world, but I do know one thing, that Mr. Onassis would not have married Mrs. Khrushchev. So,
that's a tough question, but I think that's anyone's.
Yeah. Joe, did you have a question back here? Actually, right over here. Joseph Frazier, right here.
Good afternoon, Joseph Frazier, Resilient Technologies. Sir, you seem to have had an opportunity to actually meet the personality of a great leader. As a distinguished leader of consequence, what did you find to be his greatest motivation to be a better leader? And if you could add into that, what were the extreme personal effects that 9/11 had in his leadership style and how he wants to go forward now? Thank you.
I think he saw 9/11 as a moment where his faith was abused. He saw 9/11 as a moment where his faith was hijacked and extremely embarrassed, extremely saddened that a group of people would kill so many innocent people using religion as their justification. So I think that moment, or maybe before that, but at least that moment certainly played a key role in the mind of King Abdullah, that he wasn't going to allow, from that moment on, his faith, to be taken hostage. He wasn't going to allow his faith to be used as a weapon of mass destruction. And that's why he took on the challenge of extremism head on. He wasn't going to mince words. He calls them deviants. And he's challenging them head on. And I think that's what makes him consequential. He doesn't mince words when it comes to the extremists. And that's why he's held these dialogues with the Pope, with Jewish leaders, with other religious leaders, because he feels that religion has a place only in the heart and not as a tool or a weapon to be used to kill innocent people. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
We had another question right over here. Could we get a microphone down in the front?
Going back to Iran and
Could you identify yourself and your organization?
I'm George. I'm a supporter of CSIS. Can Saudi Arabia accept a nuclear Iran?
This is a question that I would venture to say you'd have to ask the Saudis. But you want my personal opinion? I don't think the Saudi Arabia wants a nuclear Iran. Who would? When you have a leader, Mr. Khamenei, Mr. Ahmadinejad, who've made very clear, by the way, incidentally, in their speeches in Farsi, if you listen to Ahmadinejad, you listen to Khamenei in Farsi, which I do every Tuesday through the Voice of America, they are very anti-monarchy. They do not like monarchies. They believe they're anathema. to their way of thinking. And so, you know, in Farsi, they make themselves very clear. They are against monarchies. And so I would venture to say in Riyadh, in Manama, in Doha, they'd be very concerned about a nuclear Iran. Having said that, you know, it really right now depends on the United States, what the United States does in terms of what Iran is doing. I have my own personal feelings and opinions of what needs to be done, but you're asking about Saudi Arabia. The answer is Saudi Arabia would not want to see a nuclear Iran because I think they feel that it would raise tensions. And keep in mind, there's another point that I'd like to emphasize here. King Abdullah sees Saudi Arabia as the custodian of the two holy mosques, but the custodian of the world's largest reserves of petroleum. This is a commodity that his advisors tell me he thinks belongs to the world. Okay? So he doesn't want $100 barrel oil or $150 because he knows it's going to hurt the consumer. Now, does he want a fair return? Obviously. But the point being, he realizes that a nuclear Iran could be a game changer in terms of energy security. And that's why he would probably be opposed.
Does that answer your question? There was another question in the back there.
Yes, right.
Will this be our final question? Congratulations on your give and take. Just as an aside, on the subject of succession, if they Google Prince Turki Faisal, a former Georgetown student and former ambassador, he has a piece on how the system works. So you Google Turki Faisal, Al-Faisal, the youngest son of King Faisal.
Yeah, is there a final, someone else have a question? Great. With that, I'd like to thank Dr. Sabani for this presentation today. Please, on the way out, there will be books, and Dr. Sabani has agreed to stay and sign them. Thank you for coming to CSIS, and this presentation will also be posted on our website at www.csis.org. Thanks very much.